Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're here to continue our draft shows with our third in the series. Tonight, talking about the interior offensive lineman in this draft. Pretty thin class, I would say. And here to join me to talk about it with is one of my favorite people to talk football in any type, any time of year, any discussion, Michael Crawford. How are you doing, Michael?
Hey, Ken. I'm doing well. It's always fun to talk to you. Thanks for having me on. And you know that I can take any thin conversation and make it a thicker conversation.
you and me both. We have a way of making a conversation longer. And generally speaking, I do not get complaints about that from the listeners. So let's do what we always do and have this conversation be the length we need it to be. So we're talking about the interior offensive line to start with. And I guess maybe we start out by talking a little bit about the Ravens situation, obviously, with Linderbaum still around. But the Ravens have lost their North Star and Kevin Zeitler to the Lions. Simpson got a contract from the Jets that I still am shaking my head at. And the Ravens have interior offensive line needs. They have two potential guys in-house, in Voorhees and Cleveland. Want to hear what you think about that. And then we saw a lot of money thrown at guards this offseason. So let's talk about all those topics here before we get started.
Yeah, the guard market kind of went crazy in free agency. I mean, we definitely saw some guys get some big, big deals. It was surprising to me. I mean, I guess I was trying to make sense of it, like as it was happening and then kind of after it happened. Sometimes you can kind of look at these things, like I guess if you go back a couple of years ago with wide receiver, and I think you could kind of see it coming. They were like, there'll be some initial contracts, maybe like onesie twosie kind of thing. And you're like, hey, that might have been the tipping point for where this was going. And maybe there was something there with guard, maybe even last year that I'm missing. But yeah, it kind of went to another stratosphere this year. But specifically for the Ravens, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, anytime you lose starting players, you lose your starting left guard, you lose your starting right guard, you lose your starting right tackle. Not that, you know, they haven't had to deal with similar situations in the past. I did another little side project, kind of going back and looking at the Ravens offensive lines throughout history. Mm-hmm. People may have seen Ryan Mink, who writes for the Ravens. He did a similar thing. It was kind of funny, the timing of it, because he put his thing out and somebody who had been following me and had seen, you know, the sheet that I put out, I was like, hey, look, my great mind. I was like, yeah, I think it's just one of those random things that happens. But they've been in similar situations before. They've had to rebuild the group, and they've done it in a variety of different ways, which is kind of cool to go back through time and like, oh, I didn't remember that happened that way. So that actually, that context made me feel a little better about it. Gave me a little more of a comfortable feel about, okay, we don't quite know how it's going to shake out this time, but this is not unprecedented for them.
Mm-hmm. I'm much more concerned, honestly, about the tackle situation than I am the guard, because the barriers to entry are so high. At guard, one of the things that really struck me is the incredible money being paid to guards. There's a dichotomy and one thing that really makes sense. The first dichotomy is that I can't believe Zeitler doesn't get paid in a market where you're giving the kind of money you did to all these other players. Zeitler probably... maybe Hunt's the best guard out there, but I think, you know, if you're looking at the next 2 years kind of thing, or the next 3 years, but I can't believe anybody wouldn't think like for 2024 that Kevin Zeitler wasn't right there at the top of available guards and wouldn't, you know, give him a contract that reflects that. And you know, it's true. He's an older player. The surprise you're going to get from Kevin Zeitler is a bad one. It's not going to be a good one in terms of what happens, if any. But it still shocked me that he got only $6 million from the Lions.
Yeah, I wondered about those two factors. Obviously, the age is the first thing, and you kind of know how the league feels about older players in general. The Ravens maybe are the exception to that in terms of their willingness to bring in some older players at different positions. But then I also wondered about that knee injury. I wondered if it was maybe just a little more significant than what's been publicized. I don't know that there's been a lot said about it or a lot shared about it, but I just couldn't combining all these things that you already talked about, how he's performed. Yeah, he's up there in age a little bit, but it's not like there was a significant drop off in performance, I don't think, due to age. I think injury might have played a larger role in any kind of, you know, decline in performance that he had. So I just wondered if maybe there's something there with the knee that maybe was a little bit more significant that had teams maybe a little more standoffish.
I think you could argue that these were the three best years of Zeitler's career that occurred consecutively. He's been a very, very complete, very good lineman for a long time. I actually thought he might be done early in 23 because he had a very bad three-game start that was uncharacteristically bad to start the season. And he'd actually done the same thing, I think, in 22 or 21 because the year they played the Lions, that would be 21. But it looked like, you know, looked like he might be in some trouble in terms of coming to the end of the line. Then all of a sudden he turned it on and was unbelievably consistent the rest of the way. And he and Linderbaum were 1-2 in terms of the Ravens linemen, or maybe 1-1A, very, very close. Moses behind him, very, very close as well in terms of how high quality a season he had as I scored it and relative to the positional grading curve, I'll say, because at center it's a little harder to get a high letter grade, but you know, the number grades work the same way. It was a shock to me. Zeitler's already taking all the risk by taking a 1-year deal. Huh. You know, whereas the teams are taking the risk on Hunt or other players and being multi-year deals. Yeah. Simpson, please explain that one in terms of the dollars paid.
Baltimore North. I don't know how else you can explain it other than they just, I mean, obviously people know, you know, Joe Douglas came from here and kind of grew up and cut his teeth here and has an affinity for the same types of players. Obviously we'll be seeing and have kind of already seen the same thing out there in Los Angeles with the Chargers now. So you get another sort of team that's going to siphon some of those same players or at least be attracted to some of those same players. But yeah, I don't know. Good for John. You know, I'm glad that, you know, he was able to get that kind of contract and he earned it, I think, with, you know, how he was able to play last year. But, you know, I don't know. I'm always a little uncomfortable with that because I'm just like, well, hey, I mean, that was the market, I guess. So.
A lot of penalties. And it was a penalty problem that he never solved coming from the Raiders. The Ravens tried all sorts of psychological tricks, frankly, to get him to be more accountable for these penalties. And I think they had to just throw up their arms in the end and say, it's not working. We got to let him go. And, you know, I heard no discussion ever of an attempt to re-sign him. Yeah. And I can't believe the Ravens thought he would have gone for as much as he did go for, but maybe, you know, they were in contact with his agent. Maybe they already had discussions. It's just, you know, he came in, he had one penalty every 95.4 snaps with the Raiders, 17 and 1,622 snaps, I think it was. And then it comes to Baltimore, and he has one every 95.5 snaps, which at that rate of improvement, he'll be good by the year 3,000.
He's consistent. if nothing else, he's consistent.
Yes. That's what you consistent at a unstable level is just one of the weirdest phenomenons when it occurs. You know, it's luck driven, but it's still ridiculous. And with him, it's always the really serious post-snap fouls. It wasn't a bunch of false starts, which would be annoying, but I could live with them. They're much less serious penalties. A false start and IDP, we've talked about on this show many times. Big difference in terms of the impact of that play because of the defensive option.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the gift and the curse with a guy with his play style. Now, everybody who has a similar play style doesn't necessarily have that same rate of penalty occurrence. But, you know, he is a mauler. He's a phone booth type of guy. That's his play style. And, you know, I think there can be a gift and a curse that comes with that when you have that play style. But then also on the other hand, maybe you have some athletic limitations, right? So where people who maybe are a little more physically or athletically gifted who have that same kind of demeanor can maybe protect themselves and get themselves out of some of those situations a little bit more before a flag is thrown. Somebody with a little less of that is just gonna latch on and just try to, you know, bear maul you until they can't anymore. And often you're gonna get called for some of that stuff.
Yeah, you hold all the way to the corner and beyond. There's a interior lineman or two in this draft who I've really noticed has the ability to let go that I've noticed in some of this that I'm sure we'll talk about tonight. But let me just frame this up one more time. So you're Joe Douglas. You're sitting somewhere up in the New York, New Jersey area, and you're making this decision on whether or not to bring in Simpson. Maybe you're talking to your people and say, well, look, I see the problem here. John Simpson has a lot of penalties. Your guy says, yeah, but the Ravens knew that when they picked him up. And he goes, yeah, but I think our coaches can work that out of him. Really? Your coaches over the Ravens coaches? The Ravens coaches have a history of turning mediocre athletes into pretty good guards in particular. I mean, make James Hurst into a guard. You could make Bradley Bozeman into a guard. That was a big knock on him coming out of Alabama. This is no athlete at all.
Yeah.
And, they made a pretty good pulling guard out of him. So if the Ravens can't fix him, why on earth would the Jets think they could?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a persistent thing in the league, at whether it's, in this case, we're talking specifically about John Simpson, but at other positions too. We see it every year where there's some player that has a pretty clear track record of what they are at a certain point, but there's a team who will roll the dice because they think they can get something different out of them.
Yeah.
Never saying you should fail. I don't know why, but there's always somebody who's like, yeah, I get all of that, but we're going to be different.
At least I liked the Ravens' different approach of playing the mind games with it. You know what? I'm going to stop talking about John Simpson because we're going to talk about the NFL draft here. And much as I love having these thought experiments with you, we're just going to move on. Okay. So the first thing, one of the first questions you asked when you picked IOL, and I said, great, you know, we'll book for that date and whatnot, is you asked, point of clarification, are we including people that are tackles currently or were in college and are going to end up somewhere in the interior? And I said, do whatever you like, but I'm including tackles that I think will move to guard or center in the guard tackle. Sorry, the guard center group.
Yeah, it's always a bit of a projection with guys who fall into that category because, and we'll talk about it as we go through some of these guys, you'll have guys who play tackle, maybe even play tackle exclusively in college, but are projected to move inside to guard, some even to center, to guard or center. You'll have other guys who played guard and project more as a center, you know. So it's weird. I think what I initially did with my initial list, and I've kind of, you know, moved it around a little bit with the rankings, was I initially, just because I kind of wanted to go through this exercise in my head, was I was only going to look at guys that played guard, where I actually had snaps that I could watch them playing guard, right? That was initially what I did. And I knew that there were other players that maybe didn't fall into that category or played very, you know, a very limited amount of snaps at guard. And I wanted to include them too. So I did end up looking at them too, but I started with that kind of first approach just to say, okay, if I had to set aside the projection and just say, I've seen this guy play right guard, I've seen this guy play left guard, what kind of list does that generate? And then at the end, I'll broaden it out, bring in the guys who maybe only play tackle or mostly play tackle, but are projecting at guard, you know, by the media, say out there, some draft analysts, and then see how that shakes the list up by putting them in, you know, bringing them back in at the end of the process.
All right. So let's hear your group of guys that you included at interior offensive line, even though they played primarily tackle in college.
All right. So the total group or the guys that I ended up ranking? Because some guys aren't in, I include them.
But sure. I've got a couple of guys that I didn't end up ranking, but I had on honorable mentions or whatever. But whoever you want to name here, who is primarily a tackle that you consider relevant that you said I'm putting him in the IOL.
Okay. I'll start. I'd probably say J.C. Latham, even though I know he did play some guard early in his career, but he kind of ended up playing more right tackle at Alabama. I actually have those numbers. What did I have? Yeah. 27 starts and 28 games at right tackle, eight games played at right guard. So he was a guy I really like as a guard. Certainly can play tackle, probably where he will start out in the league, but I think he could be a beast at guard, just my personal opinion. And then I don't know how you pronounce Troy's last name, so if I get it wrong, forgive me. Fatanu Yeah. Fata'anu. I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
It's the problem is we've got a Fatano, a Fashaga, a Fashaga.
But Troy, another guy who played mostly left tackle at Washington, like 30 starts in 33 games, only two at left guard. But I think probably could same category as Latham. Maybe you could keep him at out at tackle. I think there's some physical concerns that some people have about him kind of staying at tackle in the league, but you know, maybe he gets a shot there. But he's another guy where I like the way that Dane Brugler phrases this, where it's not that they can't play tackle, but they maximize what they can be at guard, in his opinion. So I think those two guys fall into that category for me. Jordan Morgan, another guy, exclusively tackle. I don't think he played in games. Now, I read some articles where he talked about cross-training and other positions in practice or in like spring practice, stuff like that. But I don't think he played anything but tackle in games at Arizona. So he's another guy that way. I don't put Graham Barton in that category, even though he played tackle this year, because he has played on the interior at Duke. So I don't necessarily put him in that category, but I guess you could, because he most recently played at tackle. I guess Brandon Coleman, TCU, could kind of fit. He's also played guard, but he most recently played tackle. So a couple guys like that I have in my group.
Okay, so first of all, the primary and the high round tackles, I wanted to be consistent about them. So I left basically all of them with the exception of Barton, who I think is very clearly an interior player. I left Morgan, Fatano, obviously, is not moving. But
yeah, there's another one. I forgot about him. So Fashanu, Fuaga, and Fatano.
Taliese Fuaga is another one who might have moved inside, and he might, that may be his best position, but I think he's going to get his first job at right tackle. Yeah. And a lot of these guys, since they're likely first round picks, or, you know, by midway in the second, that's a lot of draft capital for some team not to believe there's a premium for them playing tackle over them playing guard. Yeah. So some team is going to think they're worth more than the team who thinks they're, oh, that's a good guard, let's go get him, right, to make him play tackle. So I left all those guys at tackle. The only guy of real significance that I moved over was Graham Barton. And then a couple guys a little lower who still were hanging around trying to be on my list, or maybe not. I'm not giving it away yet. Matt Goncalves of Pittsburgh and Dominic Puni, are guys that I put on the interior. So I only ended up with three guys. I thought it was going to be about six, but I ended up treating the first round and first 45 pick tackles as tackles for the most part. So I wanted to be consistent about that. But I think the talk is already out there that Barton, guard or center, build your offensive line around him in a lot of ways, and don't try and make him try and be a tackle.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and jump right into it. And we go 10 down. You know how it goes. You're the guest. Please start us off with your number 10.
Okay. I think I'm gonna surprise us right out of the box here, because I may have a name that people haven't maybe heard as much about. Willis Patrick out of TCU. I ended up getting Willis in at 10. We talked a little bit earlier today, and I was kind of shifting Willis and Mason McCormick and Bo Limmer, kind of that last spot, shifting all these guys around. But I ended up settling on Willis Patrick at 10. Played right guard this last year at TCU. Started all 12 of the games that he played in. Pretty interesting journey to TCU. He actually started at Division II Angelo State. transferred up to Jackson State the year that Coach Prime was there, and they went 12-1, and then transferred up again to the Power Five level at TCU. So that kind of progression always kind of catches my eye, because look, it's very difficult to move from level to level like that. And then when you think about him doing it this most recent time, I think Angelo State, he was there for two or three seasons before going to Jackson State, but it was only 1 year from Jackson State to TCU. So that's a pretty quick jump. We'll probably talk about that again when we talk about Puni, because he did a similar thing. But those always kind of catch my eye. But just in terms of what I saw when I watched him, it was interesting, because he was at the Shrine game, and it was actually one of their scouts, one of the guys who scouts for that game, who tweeted about him maybe about a week or two ago and said that, you know, this is a guy who's got starting guard potential who nobody's talking about. And so I went and I looked And I guess I'd seen him already because I was watching Coleman and I didn't realize who he was. You know how that is. Sometimes you're watching one specific guy and there's another guy on the line and you're not paying attention to him, but you see flashes. And you're like, I wonder who that guy is. Sometimes it's enough where I stop and I'll look right then and there, like, who is that? What number, you know, who's number 71? But I didn't do that this time. And I think it was because I was watching some older games of Coleman because I wanted to see him at guard. So I didn't see this past year. I'd gone back to 2022 before Patrick got to TCU. So I came back, watched him against Texas because we know they got some studs on their interior mm-hmm. D-line with Byron Murphy and Devondre Sweat. And Patrick really, he really acquitted himself well, in my opinion. I don't have official measurements for him because I think he was at that Big 12 pro day. He didn't have like an individual pro day and he wasn't at the combine. So I don't think they've released official results from that Big 12 pro day or Big 12 pro days because I think they held it over a couple different days. But TCU's website lists him at, I think it was 6'4", 338 pounds. He looks like he's, I don't know about his height exactly, but he looks like he's in that 320 to 340 weight range for sure, mm-hmm. just looking at his body type. And he moved well for a guy with that kind of mass. I'm just looking at some of my notes. He was able to bend. He had active hands. When I talk about active hands, for me, it's guys who are able to re-leverage and refit their hands and then kind of get into that combat sort of technique with the defensive lineman when they're trying to throw their moves. You're able to sort of combat and counter some of their moves instead of just kind of putting your hands on a guy and keeping them there no matter what he does. I mean, sometimes you're in a block where you have to do that. Other times you really got a hand fight to try to keep a leverage position against a guy. And I thought he was pretty adept at doing that. Didn't have a big windup, which is something I really like too, right? You think about the old Westerns with a cowboy drawing from the holsters, you know, getting your elbows wet. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a big windup. Pretty consistent inside hand placement. He carried his hands inside and he would keep them that way when he struck so that he would get his hands inside and get to a defender's chest plate. So I like that. Pretty nasty play demeanor. Pretty unique to see a guy use a two-hand punch as much as he did. You don't see that as much anymore. You see a lot mm-hmm. of more independent hand, but he's got some jolt in his strike when he punches people. So all of that kind of caught my eye, and to see him have some one-on-one reps against Murphy and Sweat where he kind of really held his own, you know, that's why I have him on the list where I do.
Okay, so I had not looked at him at all until you gave me that name today. And I just I didn't have time to go back and search for film of him and whatnot, even though it was available certainly for TCU because of the other players on that line, as you mentioned. But, you know, a guy who's only penalized twice the whole season. It's interesting you brought up the Texas game because if you look at the PFF, you can't go by the scoring because he might have been perfectly fine for 68 out of 70 plays or whatever it was. But he shows up with a really poor pass blocking grade that day. Couple pressures surrendered, and it is what it is, you know, but very consistent pass blocker for the season. Very, very consistent. So you probably, if that was the worst he was all year, and it was probably pretty close, I'm surprised about that. There was another player who got a 29 from PFF this year in a game that I looked at it as part of this process, and it was available cut up. And I, you know, you watch every snap, but yeah, I mean, maybe it wasn't perfect, but it certainly did not look like a 29. You know, from what I was just looking at, I wasn't doing play-by-play scoring as I usually do. And, you know, that will trick you if you don't really try and get down to it. If you, oh, I see what it was, then you run the risk. But, you know, penalized only two times all year.
And I wonder with Patrick in that game, because actually when you brought that up, I hadn't looked at the grades at all, but mm-hmm. I had this note from my film study that Sweat, number 93, beat him inside twice with a swim move. Does he have the foot quickness to recover versus inside move? So he did get beat clean mm-hmm. with two swim moves that led to a pressure. So I had that in my notes. And I know with PFF, sometimes, you know, that can sort of skew the weighting of the scoring when you see like real clean wins that lead to quick pressures and stuff like that. He definitely got beat clean twice by Sweat with that same move.
The other thing I really liked about Patrick Willis, and this is something that come up regularly in this group, is the guys who are great pass blockers and not as good run blockers. And he is definitely, he's a pass blocker more than a run blocker. Despite that size, you would think he'd be able to just push people right off the line of scrimmage and whatnot. And he should be Ben Cleveland. Ben Cleveland actually falls in this category too. He's a pretty good pass blocker and has some, you know, basically makes some mistakes as a run blocker sometimes. Does get great push occasionally, but he also makes some mistakes. The guys who are good pass blockers and bad run blockers, when you have that combination, if you're going to be one way heavy, that's the way to be. You don't want to be a good run blocker who's a bad pass blocker. There's no place for that in the NFL. But you, if you you want to be a good pass blocker, bad run blocker. Anyway, was not a bad season for him at all. PFF has had him for 10 total pressure events. That's all I'm going to quote on this show because I don't really believe they attribute the sacks and hits correctly. Like they won't give somebody a third of a sack. They'll just give him a hurry instead. So we're not really getting a good notion that the guy didn't participate in any sacks, which is exactly what you would have from doing this. I bet that is not true. I bet there were sacks off his initial pressure that occurred, that they're not calling sacks. They're just calling pressure because somebody else finished on the play. But anyway, it is what it is. And I appreciate you bringing a new name to the group like this. I think that's a great one to start with at number 10.
Yeah, and I like hearing that side of it from you when we do these, sort of the PFF grade side, because I don't look at it at all purposely, because mm-hmm. I think sometimes, just speaking for myself, it can bias me one way or the other. Like if I see it and I see the grade, I'm like, oh, that's a high grade. I'm expecting something good here. And then I don't get it and I'm let down, or the other way around. It's a low grade and I see something, you know, maybe that I feel is better than that. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Is it me or is it? So I try not to look at them at all. I try to just go straight by the film until I'm done. And then I'm open to hearing them because I'm curious. Like, okay, well, did what I see line up? Is there something like in this case where it maybe doesn't necessarily when you hear me describe it, but then I have a line where I saw two specific plays, at least there probably were others, but I saw at least two. And I'm like, okay, I'm maybe not totally off track with what I was seeing.
Yeah. I understand that. And I think that's a good way to do it. The very first thing I like to look at is one single game all the way cut up for one player. That's the best thing I can start with if it's available. If it's not, I'll try and look at game film, and then I've got to be able to have some DVR type control, which can be a little bit difficult to find, but it is out there, to try and look at one play at a time. Even the YouTube bar and using that is something, but it's not probably ideal. I don't need the player highlighted. You probably see this now all the time, but when you have a cut up, and it's one player who's basically playing the same position. If it's a defensive player and they're an edge player, it's a little different, but because they might be on either side. But once you know what the player looks like, I don't need the guy highlighted every play. I don't know about how you feel about that.
Yeah, especially like offensive line, and you know that they're at one spot. Like you can do it the first play of the cut up, and then after that, I'm good. We don't need to see it every single play. But no, I do a similar thing. So a lot of the film that I watch is, well, I don't want to get in too deep in the weeds here, is stuff that, let's say, ultimately ends up getting shared on Google Drive. Let's just put it that way.
Your dark web processes are noted, and
let's just put it that way. But you're able to slow that down to like 25 times because I have to watch stuff slowly. Like I can I watch it at regular speed, but when I'm really trying to understand what's happening in a particular rep, I gotta slow it down. That's just me. Maybe I'm old, I don't know, but I have to slow it down, and then I have to watch it a couple times if there's a specific play and I'm like, well, wait a minute, what actually happened here? Where are his hands? What do you do with his feet? What happened here? Why did this guy disengage? Why did this happen? So I got to slow it down and watch a couple times. So my process is pretty slow, actually, because that's how I have to do it. And I'll even screen record a bunch. I mean, if you only knew, I've probably got 4,000 clips just from this draft season.
Very cool.
But then I can control it. I can control the playback speed. I can zoom. I can do all these different things because I have to see the picture that clearly. Like some people can just watch it full speed on a TV screen. They'll tell you like 10 things that happen. I can't do that.
It's really interesting you say that because I know we have different views on the need for all 22, which I think is the icing on the cake is how I look at it. But if there was one view that was not available and it was the current quality of all 22 film versus the TV copy, I'd work with the TV copy first and foremost. TV copy gives me up to 4K, but usually, you know, at least a 1080i broadcast is being done there. I have the full DVR control. I can do the timing of the play down to 3/100ths of a second if I want to do that. I have all sorts of control over that. And for the most of the things I do for offensive line play in particular, 97% of the time, it's okay. We go through a typical game of offensive line scoring out. I might have about 10 plays where for one player, I need to look back and see, have an all 22 check on what happened on that play to see if I want to score it differently, to see if I didn't, you know, you get really good horizontal depth with the TV copy, obviously, you get really great vertical depth. You get really great horizontal depth with the all 22 to be able to tell just how close was he to the quarterback when from that end zone view. You don't get as good a view of that from the TV copy, obviously, but most of the time it's good enough. And I know we got our own different ways of doing this. I think there's aficionados who like both as the thing, but for me, draft season is great. I probably look at more A22 footage than I do during the season combined. Mm-hmm. Looking at all games, looking whatever I might look at during the season, I probably look at less all 22 in a whole Ravens season than I look at during one draft. So it's just a different look, and it definitely does not give me that same level of control I'm used to when I'm doing it.
I'm very spoiled, man, because when I first started doing this stuff, only the YouTube like TV broadcast cut-ups were what was available, or you could watch the full games, but that was the only thing that was available. They didn't have access to A22. I mean, this was pre-game rewind days, so there wasn't any of that. And now it's like I can't live without it. I've gone like the other extreme. I do like both. I'm not somebody who's like, I won't watch, broadcast, viewers, because I think there are advantages and disadvantages to both. So I think the best approach is probably to use some combination of both, just my opinion, because there are things that you can see on the TV copy that you don't see on the A22. There's certainly things you hear. That might be the more important part on the broadcast, especially with the field mics. Like if you really get into like cadence and stuff like that, which, I kind of went down that rabbit hole one year. It's pretty cool to be able to hear that stuff and then try to line it up with what you think those calls mean. It's all a guess for me. So.
All right. Fair enough. Willis Patrick, what round would you have him going?
I'm prepared for that. You hit me with one. I did the rankings. I didn't think about that.
You can think about it for a little question. Bit. I don't want to get you all going there. I'll talk about my number 10 guy here for a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Trevor Keegan of Michigan. And I like Willis Patrick a little bit more in the sense that he's at least a different type of player, but Trevor Keegan was competing with one other guy for the 10th spot. I really had trouble deciding on which one was the one, but Keegan is the one I ended up going for. He'll be 24 in August. We don't have a birthday, by the way, on Willis Patrick that I was able to find. You don't have one in your thing.
Me neither.
6'5", 315, kind of shortish arms at 32 and 5'8", 741 in the three cone at his pro day. Now, I do take that with a grain of salt. Pro day. It's not a combine measurement. It's a pro day measurement. Right. Jumped well at the combine. So got some explosiveness. That's always good for an offensive lineman. To me, he's pretty much, he can't be a tackle anymore given his arm length there. He has kind of a lighter athletic frame. He's been a four-year starter at left guard, so I guess there'd be no question about him moving out to tackle at this point. But here's a problem, is that his strength is really not commensurate with his age. You don't really see a guy who's just powering people off the line of scrimmage. You see a guy who is going to need a year in an NFL weight room. Why do I even mention that? Because that's true a lot of rookie linemen. Well, it is, but you don't want it to be true of the 24-year-old rookie lineman. You want it to be true of the 22-year-old rookie lineman, but not the 24-year-old rookie lineman. Yeah. So that is a general problem. I think there's some things he does very well. He generates some good torque. He turns through the block well when he's sealing to the inside. So he's a left guard. They didn't pull to that side as often. When he's the pulling guard, he's reasonably good at just standing his man up. He doesn't really try and finish him like you'll see some other guards do. But I like the. When he is the gate opener, his ability to turn that defensive tackle looked pretty good to me. What else do I have? Been a solid pass blocker, better pass blocker than he has been a run blocker. The big issue for him is he's an extremely upright athlete, and he does not play super low, which he would have to at 6'5", 315. He's got kind of a lighter athletic frame for a lineman. You still look at him. He's a big guy. So saying light frame is always kind of a weird thing. But to me, he's a guy who is going to have trouble standing up to monsters every Sunday opposite him at defensive tackle. Michael Pierce in the league is just would be the kind of guy who would just give Trevor Keegan absolute fits in this. I did like the fact that he probably played his best ball of the season in the playoffs against Alabama, against Washington. He looked terrific. Both those games might have had one pressure in the two games, and that was really good. He's a Michigan connection. I don't like that at all. I really don't like the bias that that potentially brings into play, but I think it is more likely the Ravens will go to him a little early. If I had to guess, he's a round five, round six guy. Let me say what I mean by that. When I say he's a round five, round six guy to the Ravens, that means that's where I think he drops into the Ravens' value range. Please don't tell me somebody else has got him at 97 or 102 or 104 on their list, and we can't possibly get this guy if we wait till round five. The Ravens wait on 20 guys every year. That's the beauty of it. And the one that drops through is going to be the guy they get a value grade on. And yeah, they didn't get the other 19, but they got somebody at tremendous value. And they don't, you know, not reaching for a player like Trevor Keegan is very important in the NFL draft, because there's somebody else not named Trevor Keegan who will also be available.
Yeah, and I think we just heard recently, I don't know if you've seen it yet, it's kind of been making the rounds. Mm-hmm. Eric DaCosta spoke at some sort of sports conference at Penn State. Yeah. And he talked about that number specifically. I think he said anywhere from 125 to 150 players, maybe max, that they will grade and have on their board. And there's probably, what, well over 200 plus?
Yeah, 255 or 256 is Mr. Irrelevant usually, because it's eight rounds of 32.
Yeah, so it's a pretty clear indication that they value players differently, right? Mm-hmm. In some cases. I mean, there's going to be some probably consensus on the top upper echelon guys. But I think just the fact that number, and you say about the Patriots all the time too, I think their number was even smaller than that. They had some ridiculously small number of guys that they had on their board because it was so role specific what they were looking for. So when I hear those numbers, to me, that's telling me, okay, they value players differently than the rest of the league. And that Michigan bias, I'm hoping now that Jim is back, that he'll dilute some of that. He'll take those guys before John is able to get his hands on those guys, because he's got a more recent Michigan connection and a stronger Michigan connection, I guess. But you never know how it may be a battle over Michigan, because there's going to be a bunch of Michigan guys, not just on the old line, but like all throughout that roster who probably get drafted this year.
A lot of his coaching staff came with him, you know, so there's certainly going to be elements of that there, I would think. And, you know, Michigan, having just won a national championship, their players are in demand. So all over the league, there'll be people looking for them. So I did not have Willis Patrick on my list. Did you have Trevor Keegan on yours, and other thoughts on him?
I did not have Trevor Keegan on mine. He's somebody that I did take a look at early in the process. I kind of have different time phases to when I do this stuff. I'll do it not a whole lot during the season, mostly during the season. It might just be TV watching, like TV scouting, not scouting, but just watching people on TV, you know, different matchups, different games. But then usually around January, February-ish, before the Senior Bowl, before the Shrine Bowl, I'll start watching certain guys. So he was a guy that I had watched early on. I hadn't gone back to watch him since then, but who I watched early on. And that was kind of one of the thing that you mentioned about his frame was kind of one of the things that stood out to me too. And I've seen that as I've gone through this process, where I could probably put them into buckets of the guys that kind of have that wider, more mass, big, they look like your prototype NFL offensive guard, and other guys
Air who have a thinner apple.
Yeah. Like Puni's a guy we'll talk about, you know, a taller, leaner guy who you're like, I don't know. So I think Keegan, you know, kind of fits into that category too. It's not that those guys can't find a home and have some success, but it's just your eyes. I read this recently, Bill Parcells, and I think he said when he first came into the league, and he learned from this personnel guy named Buck O'Kilroy. And Buck O'Kilroy apparently told him, son, you need to learn who's doing these jobs, right? So who do these guys look like? What do they do? That's who you need to go find. Because he said, what we want is a team full of prototypes, not a team full of exceptions. So, okay. You know, you can certainly find exceptions in the league. We all know kind of who those guys are, and it's not a bad thing, but you can get yourself in some trouble if you got too many exceptions.
Yeah. We're perfectly happy with Kyle Hamilton at slot corner and the exceptions he brings to that position.
Absolutely.
But yeah. It's absolutely true that generally speaking, you want pears at guard and you want apples at tackle. And you could probably have either at center, because it can be either type. And that's why a lot of guys move directly from tackle to center, like Christensen a couple of years ago, and people like that, the BYU guy. All right. So we've we're 38 minutes in and we've got our first player done. Let's pick up the pace here with your number nine guy.
All right. I'm going to try to do like they do during the draft for NFL Network, where they have like the baseball card, they call it, of the player, and you get like three bullet points. You say three things about it, and that's it.
I see. You're going to cut me down here.
All right. Number nine, Isaiah Adams, Illinois. Do have an age on him. 23 years old is what I was able to find out there with him. Senior, started all 25 of the 25 games he played at Illinois is kind of what I have him tracked down for. Played a couple different spots, left guard, right tackle. You know, interesting story. I'll just real quick, not going to go deep. He's from Canada. So that's the interesting thing that I have with him. He was born in Ajax, Ontario, Canada, which, as you would imagine, would cause him to have maybe some different sports in his background. I'm always intrigued by guys that have multi-sport backgrounds. Football, basketball, pretty routine, but rugby is another sport that he played growing up. So he's got a little bit of a different thing there. But I liked him more at guard than I did at tackle. I want to say 2023, I think he played tackle. I'm getting the years confused because I go back. I know a lot of people.
Tackle in 2023, left guard in 2022.
Okay. I know a lot of people only do the current year stuff, but I always like to go back. Especially if they play different positions, but also sometimes you get to see matchups. You get to see them against guys who've already been drafted into the NFL. And now you know how those guys have done in the NFL in their rookie season or their second year. So you can kind of gauge it that way. So I like to go back and do that for that reason. But he was a guy, again, similar to some of the things I said about Patrick. I like the fact that he pretty consistently made first meaningful contact. Like, it's one thing to just get your hands there first, but to get them there in a position where you can control the block, I think is important. So that's kind of how I look at meaningful contact. He did that pretty consistently in the games that I watched. He's definitely got a finishing mentality. He's out there trying to send a message. That's for sure. You see some of the way he finishes blocks and it's like, okay, this guy's trying to set a tone. Got to walk the line with that. Cause you know, we know the extreme end of that can be like the Trevor Penning kind of thing. And it's,
yep.
People start focusing more on what you're doing after the snap than what you're doing during the snap, which is the most important part. I don't think Adams is on that end of the scale. I think he's more kind of just, yeah, I'm going to let you know I'm here all day, which I'm okay with that. In terms of some negatives, I thought he's a little bit of a long strider, particularly when he was moving, like on pulls. And so I think that kind of affected the base that he had at times. He could, you know, kind of diffuse or dilute some of the power on contact because he was such a long strider and he would get so narrow that he didn't have that wide base to set his feet and kind of generate force and power from the ground up at times. So that was something that kind of stood out to me. He's more of a what I call a wrong arm base, where, you know, like a defensive player wants to take on a block with the wrong arm. So they're trying to spill it, right? They'll take it with their outside arm going inside the puller and try to spill the ball carry and get them to go outside, as opposed to trying to take them on and box it inside. He was kind of doing that, which was weird to see an offensive lineman do that. I was like, this wrong arm thing he's doing. So that was a little weird to me. I thought there was some inconsistency in his ID and recognition in terms of seeing games and twists and stunts. There were times where he saw it. There were times that he didn't. Maybe that's just a focus thing. Maybe he got fooled a couple of times. That certainly happens. I don't know, but that was just something that also caught my eye. But I did like him more at guard than I did at tackle.
Yeah. I okay. So a few things about this. Let me just start with this. And first thing, I so appreciate doing the show with you, because now you're two for two bringing up names that I did not include in my review. Okay. So two for two. Now, in Adam's case, he's actually a really good name from the past to bring up, because he had a good year at guard in 2022, probably was looking right on track to be drafted. In 2023, he had a disastrous year at tackle. And there are going to be some teams, and the Ravens may be one of them, that realize he was just in the wrong spot, but just a disastrous year at tackle with a whole bunch of pressure allowed, did not look good at all, terrible pass blocking grade for the season, a bunch of bad individual games during the year. So it's really a lousy year for him. But I really appreciate the fact that you're looking back at his 22 when he's actually playing the position that you think he could be drafted for, and it makes much more sense under those conditions. You know, looking at his 2 years from a statistical basis here and what PFF has given me here, he's the kind of player I would love for the Ravens to take a UDFA flyer on. I don't think there's any need to draft this guy currently. I don't think he's unless somebody else is out there being Michael Crawford in an NFL front office, which that could be, but you know, they're going to have to overlook some really bad 2023 play to remember that he was pretty good in 22. One of the problems also for him at guard in 22 is he's got the inverted split of pass and run blocking. So he's a better run blocker than he was a pass blocker then. That kind of held up a tackle. By the way, why do you think Illinois moves him to tackle when he already couldn't block on the inside? Why would they think he could block on the outside? So
I'm thinking it had to be injury related, or somebody graduated. Yeah. They're just trying to fill a spot. But like you said, I remember he was another guy who I started out watching earlier on, because I tend to watch all the Senior Bowl guys first when those invites come out, because I know how much the Ravens sort of value guys who play in that game. Mm-hmm. So I started watching him, and I started with the 2023 tape at tackle. And I think I saw one game and I was like, I can't do this. This is, this is not going to work for me. Yeah. And then I started looking him up and I was like, okay, he played guard. Let me go back and look at that to see if that's any better. And when I saw him at guard, I was like, okay, all right, I think I can deal with this. And it was a 2022 game versus Wisconsin. So you got the same matchup with Keanu Benton a couple times. So we know
that's a good one.
Pretty good rookie year with the Steelers. And they didn't have a ton of true one-on-ones. That sometimes can be hard to get with interior players. But they had a couple, and he held his own. You know, that's not like a ringing endorsement, but sometimes when you're going up against a guy like Benton, holding your own is not a bad thing.
Yep. Yeah, definitely a neutral rep would be good in that case. Benton, what, a third-round pick?
Ooh, you're no better than me.
All right. I'm going to move on here to my number nine guy. And I imagine you at least considered this guy. You might have him on your list. You might not. So this would be another interesting one. He's got a bunch of question marks that come with him. It's Mason McCormick of South Dakota State. He's nodding. He probably has him on his list. Now, the first thing is playing at South Dakota State. The second thing is playing 6 years at South Dakota State.
Ridiculous amount of games.
It's absurd. It's just absurd. 6'4", 309, good arm length, almost 34 inches. Outstanding testing across the board. I don't give you the specifics, but they're good testing across the board. All of his college experience is at left guard. So he's one of the few guys who's played, 1,000 college games? Or no, seriously, he's played about 50 college games or so. He's got, let me get the number of snaps right on this, 1,610 pass blocking snaps in college. 1,610. And only 27 pressure events, which is terrific. Consistently outstanding. If you look at him on the tape, I think he wears number 60 for them. And you don't even have to know what his number is, because he's like a half a body bigger than everybody else on the line, or at least it looks that way at South Dakota State. His number almost seems like it's outsized on the cut-up I watched. I watched a cut-up of him playing against Albany, which is an excellent one, by the way, worth the thing. And there's some good things and there's some bad things. His run blocking in space, I would say, was really inconsistent. I think it's a matter of decisiveness. He's a little slow also, but I don't think he makes up his mind on who he wants to block in space. And that's something Morgan Moses, slow-footed lineman, who makes up very quickly his mind on who his block is. It's almost like he's a robot deciding. Mm-hmm. And he almost always got a trailing block on these two-man pulls he would be a part of, which is very unusual. So it really, really, you know, jumps off the tape at you. Mason McCormick, he's the opposite. Even when he's the lead guy, sometimes he can't figure out who he wants to block and he just kind of gets stuck. That was a problem in that Albany game. Biggest player on the field, as I mentioned. He does seem to have a decent sense of when to stop blocking to avoid holding. And I mentioned that was going to come up with a couple of players. That's one of the things I really liked about him. He did pile up 10 penalties, nonetheless, in his senior year, you know, his sixth year of play here. Is Van Wilder's? Yes. Is John Belushi? His Belushi season was coming up, his 7 years of college down the drain, right? So,
67 games. That is ridiculous. Yeah, 67 games.
I mean, go on to a Power 5 program. Do something. Was there some girl that he had to stay with in South Dakota State? Why was it so important that he stay there?
Loyal dude. I mean, 50 consecutive starts at left guard. That's just at left guard. That's not, I mean, he had 17 more games he played. Yep. That's a career for a lot of guys. 50 starts at total. It's a crazy amount.
No idea where he is in terms of grown man strength is one of the problems I have, even though his age, you know, he's up there. But I have no idea where he is in terms of the NFL strength curve. He's too big for those guys, for South Dakota State's opponents, for Albany. He's too big. You know, the Ravens could really value development. They used to really like small school picks even more when DaCosta was running the small school scouting area under Ozzie. It seemed like they made even more such picks with, you know, Webb and Brandon Williams and, you know, Judon, a whole bunch of other guys who they drafted out of small schools. They've lost their way a little bit recently. And some of that may be that the transfers are becoming more regular and people are moving through the Power Five for their last season and more easily. But I think what I would assume was a DaCosta bias to pick these small school guys. Zach Seeler would be another one. You know, is something that was really Ozzie's bias, that Ozzie liked what they were doing there. So anyway, I he's number nine on my list. I think there's the kernel of a guy, and they got to wait for value on him. The value, I think, for the Ravens would be in round five for him. I don't see them pulling the trigger earlier. But again, if they don't get Mason McCormick, they'll get somebody else, would be my way of thinking about it.
Yeah, he was a guy that, I have him on my list. He was that guy that I flip-flopped back and forth for that 10 spot between him and Willis Patrick. I had him in it for most of this process. And then when I watched Willis, I ended up putting him, you know, that one spot ahead. But I actually, another old game, I was wondering about strength and sort of level of competition like you. So they played Iowa early on in 2022. So I went and I watched that. He mostly got matched up against this guy named Logan Lee, who I think is coming out in this draft. I think he's a D-tackle or D-lineman, however you want to define him. He didn't have a whole – I was hoping to see more matchups against – what's the guy that went for Iowa last year? Defensive lineman, really athletic dude. Everybody was wondering why he didn't start a bunch of games when he was there. He played, but he didn't start any games. But I'm blanking on his name. But I want to say he was a first-round pick. I think he was a first-round pick. So I wanted to see – they'll match up, and unfortunately didn't really see that very often. But even against Logan Lee, I mean, you're going up against Power Five type guys, and his grip, McCormick's grip strength was one thing that stood out to me. Like, I had that in my notes, that once he latched on the guy, especially Logan Lee tried to bull snatch him to disengage. He tried to rip to disengage, and he couldn't get off of it. You know, he just could not get off of McCormick. Now, the one sort of thing that I was wondering about in terms of that strength was, and this might be more conditioning, It looked like he started to have more issues as the game went on. Like, he sort of wore down as the game went on. Now, obviously they were, and that was a close game. It's not like they were getting like blown out or anything. I want to say it was like a one score, which if you're an
Iowa fan, plays a bunch of nothing games, don't they? So yeah.
Yeah. I say, if you're an Iowa fan, this probably sounds pretty familiar to you. But it looked like he started to wear down a little bit as that game went on, and started to kind of have, a few more losses in pass pro they had early on. I think he started out pretty strongly and kind of held his own, but it looked like as the game went on, he kind of wore down. It was the first game of the season. So maybe that's a factor too, but I liked him. Like I said, I was going to have him at 10, and I was like, look, that's somebody with some developmental traits that I'd like to work with if I was a team.
All right. Well, fantastic. So we've done two spots. We talked about four players already, and we really got to pick up the pace.
Okay. Give me number eight. We're going to go fast. Number eight, great name, Christian Mahogany, Boston College. One of my favorite names. 23-year-old, redshirt senior, tore his ACL in 2022. I mentioned that because, you know, anywhere where there was like a really significant injury, I do kind of like to, you know, sort of throw those on the record. Played left guard, played right guard. If you're looking for a guy to move people in the run game, he is your guy. He is the guy who wants to get hands on people and inflict punishment. That's his mentality. He's a mauler type of guy. Doesn't mean that he's terrible in pass pro, but because I actually saw him recover against some inside moves. This was a game against Clemson, and Clemson, pretty good interior D-line. They got a Ruka Roro, Tyler Davis, and a younger guy too, who's still there, who ended up getting hurt a year or two ago, but he was pretty good before he got hurt. Number nine or number eight. So got to see him match up a bunch with those guys. And he, you know, this wasn't just a hold your own situation. I mean, he actually was getting the best of some of these guys. So I was a big fan of his. That thing about the ACL, there was kind of a cool nugget on that. It's like he tore it early in 2022. So he's out that whole season, right? He's not playing, but he's around the team and stuff like that. They still voted him a team captain, even though he didn't play that whole season.
That's great.
So, you know, just, you know, one of those kinds of guys. And obviously we know what that line had been at Boston College at one point. Zion Johnson's there. I don't think Chris Lindstrom, I think he was gone. It was his brother, Alec Lindstrom, I think was there at that time. But they had like three or four guys. A couple of them have gone. Well, Zion obviously went into the league. I don't know about Lindstrom. but a pretty solid offensive line. But yeah, he's my number eight guy.
Okay, very good. I had him higher. I think I had him at number five, but I'm on his notes here before I go back up to scroll up to look at where I actually put him on my list. Pear-shaped build I loved. He was actually a better player, I think, in 21 before he missed the 22 season with his injury. So maybe he's another guy you look back, you see better tape than what he does.
Clemson, 2021 Clemson. That's what I watch.
So it lines up his targets very well in level two. So good combination blocker who can be the back end, but he's even more valuable when he releases and climbs to level two and catches somebody. He loves to finish. I think that's something, by the way, a lot of players, and it's not just him, but he's definitely a player who's guilty of it from time to time, really need to be careful of your teammates' feet in the pit. Do not finish across the pit. It's like should be the golden rule of offensive line blocking. You do it, you're suspended for four games or something. I'd be fine with a rule like that at the team level, just to keep your teammates safe. But it's something that, you know, and then you lose two linemen, of course, on one play because you suspend one and you have somebody else get hurt. But it's something that is a problem. Mahogany, very good blocker, man-on-man, had more trouble in zone, got his face crossed a lot. As I saw it, he's as a weird spacing does not always remain perfect. Now some teams they run a ton of zone and their spacing is just it's immaculate. You know, the old Denver teams with all they used to do with it, they were very good at keeping the spacing right and even keeping texture at multiple levels when they had the opportunity to do so was very positive. Mahogany's not a guy who instills that sort of confidence and people cross his face and he's got his arm out to the defense side to try and look at what's going on and seems to sometimes kind of lose track of where he is. Didn't like that about him. Scouting reports are kind of mixed on his ability to pass block. I look at the total pressures and I say that looks good. I don't know if we'll, you know, if there's enough for me to say. So the cutoff I watched was from that FSU game. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's first of all, excellent cutoff. It's as good stuff on him. I thought, what he did well is he looked for work very well as a pass blocker, in particular when there's a guard bubble. So guard bubble, his antenna up immediately. Who do I block? Who do I block? Look inside, look for the blitz, look outside, make that help block for the tackle last. And I thought that his order of operations there appeared to be fairly textbook. One pressure that I saw in that game, he's the guy who I believe scored a 29 pass blocking from PFF in this game. And I could not understand it, but it wasn't a whole lot of total snaps I was looking at. So it could have been a couple of non-blocks and one pressure that would have done it. He had one other recovery where he reached the time limit, but that could have well been called a loss. So, you know, you like guards who can recover as pass blockers and who have different tricks to do so. I'm sure we'll talk about that with other players, but anyway, he had one such thing. Was effective pulling, at least that's good. You know, you want to be pulling on a straight ahead blocker. They sometimes go together, sometimes they don't. So it's nice to see a guy who can pull and block straight ahead. That's actually, you know, kind of the golden ticket a lot of the times, but did not in his case mean that he's a great zone blocker. And I'd say most of his run blocks come on the defensive tackle. He's a pretty good timing to disengage and leave that center in a favorable position, typically the center, to make that block. And typically he'd be blocking then a nose tackle to the inside for the center then to be able to maintain that block. So anyway, I thought he did a pretty good job of that. Here's my concern about Mahogany. Mahogany's fairly high on a lot of boards. I think that he would fall into the Ravens value range in about round four, but I think he could go as high as the end of round two. Perhaps even the middle of round two or early in round three because of the dearth of IOL talent. There just is so little in this draft until you add in the tackles as guards and you add in the centers as something else that is going to play because there's almost like a flood of centers coming to this league from this draft. Yep. And a lot of those guys, you know, a lot of them are too small to play guard. They're a whole bunch of center only guys we're going to get to in this draft. So Mahogany's one of the few guys who's a perfect kind of a pear shaped guard. And there just aren't very many in this draft. And that's why I had him. And let me make sure this, I have five or four here. Now I had him at number five. And again, I think the value range for the Ravens would be somewhere early in round four. And the Ravens would have to be trading back to get in that position to take him.
Yeah, I had a run of guys with that body type. I think I started with Willis Patrick, but then Adams, Mahogany, Coleman. I had like this group of guys. I was like, okay, I clearly have a type right now because these guys are all like grouped together.
Yeah.
But who's your, you got, we got to do your number eight.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my number eight is Zach Zinter of Michigan. So I picked another Michigan guy. And believe me, maybe I didn't like myself
bias.
For doing it.
Maybe you got
yes. the bias. Yeah, maybe. Maybe I got the bias because I'm not trying to predict who they'll pick. I hope they don't. But 6'6", 309, 33 and a half inch arms. He has a reputation that keeps showing up at scouting reports of being a poor athlete. And then he didn't do any testing. So I say, yeah, that's probably right. that's perfect. He's an apple. He's not a pear. At 6'6", 309, he's got more of that Keegan-esque frame. Michael Orr had it too. You know, a solidly built top to bottom, but not a, you know, loaded down in the bottom like a Bobo doll is going to bounce right back up. He's I'm really old to know what that is.
I know what that is.
All right. Anyway, Zach Zinter, definitely apple out of pear. 3-year starter at right guard. It's a little bit weird. I think Michigan must have been taking guys out of this game, although I didn't notice it from the cut up I watched against Ohio State. But he must not have played all the snaps because he's playing like 45 and 55 snaps in games. And I know Michigan would have been dominating with 65, 70 snaps a lot of weeks. And he's just not in there. I don't know what they did, but somebody else is playing rotationally with him. He did break his tibia and fibula versus Ohio State late in the year, and then that forced him to miss the playoff game, which was unfortunate. I guess he still gets a championship ring, which is good, but I know he probably would have wanted to play in those playoffs. Good torque generation as he rotates through his blocks to seal. You want to see that always, particularly for a right guard, because they're going to be open the front gate more. So you want to be able to see a guy who rotates through that block as he turns that defensive tackle as he sees fit. I love to watch, by the way, Coach D, coach offensive line, and he uses torque as a verb all the time. Yeah. So torque him,
torque
you know,
him.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Torque him.
Five total pressure events and 296 passing blocks as PFF scored it. That's certainly good. A couple things from the cut up on Ohio State. Number of lockout reps where he got his hand to the body, grabbed the jersey, and the rep was over. You just mentioned this for McCormick, grip strength being a really big thing. Zach Zinter seems to have pretty decent grip strength in terms of what he did. Now, I'm watching him play against one Ohio State player most of the time. Still pretty good. He loaned pressure he allowed on that cut up came on the very last play of the film. I was like, this looks like a clean game to me. There it is. but if you want to watch it there, you can take a look and see if you agree with the scoring on that. He also had another rep early where he seemed to lose. That's fine. Several plays where a guard bubble occurred, and different from Mahogany, he was not real good about looking for work. And that's something I really do not like to see in a guard, particularly the Ravens tackles who've needed a lot of help before and really are going to need a lot of help this next year, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Really need their guards to be looking for work inside, you know, blitz stunt outside kind of thing. They need to get them. And anyway, I'm wrong about who it was, by the way. It was Zach Zinter at the 29.5 game, not Mahogany, because I've got it written down right here. Overall 29.5 grade surprised me.
Yeah, so maybe I don't have the Michigan bias because I don't have any Michigan guys on my
list. You don't have Zinter on your list. Okay, that's right. Well, then we get to talk about some extra players. That's great. Yeah. In terms of the round range, I have him probably in the Ravens value range around round four. He's a clean, careful technician, doesn't really jump off at you. But then the good thing is the Michigan guys tend to be good pass blockers. Mm-hmm. And you want that over the run blocking. And so, you know, from that standpoint at least, you know, you're getting the more valuable trait. All right. So I gave you my number eight guy. Any comments on Zinter?
No, obviously got a chance to see a lot of Michigan this year with the season that they had. And then, you know, even into the national championship game. So, you know, when I watch it, and I think this has been the case for them for a number of years now, it's like they're either winning or are the finalists for the Joe Moore Award, which was for the best offensive line in college football. And just year after year, they just churn out these lines. And this year was no different with Zinter, with Keegan, like you mentioned, with just guys who, yeah, there may be some warts or some flaws here or there, but they just find a way to work really well together as a unit and dominate games. And we know the style of football that they play too. So this is not, you know, this is big boy football that they play. And they just consistently, I guess maybe even before Sharon Moore got there, I know he's been the offensive line coach for a couple seasons now before he got the head job, but maybe even before he got there, maybe even going back to like the Ben Bredesen. Yeah. You know, that's a name Ravens fans. Yeah. I remember, but they've had good lines for last several years now.
Yeah, the Bredesen year is really the Ueno year that I'm just upset about still. Like, and the Ruiz year, and he went in the first round, he has not lived up to it. So, yep. But that interior offensive line was something that year.
Sure was.
All right, so I give you my number eight. It's time for your number seven.
Number seven. All right, I saved this guy towards the end of sort of my watching process because I knew he'd played mostly at center, very little at left guard. I think I had him for eight games earlier in his career. Zach Frazier, West Virginia, 22 years old. Junior, but might be like a COVID junior or something like that. I'll get right to the notes on him because he was a fun watch, even though I saved him to the end, even though I'm watching him at center, I wasn't able to get any of these games at guard. I don't have a ton of notes, but just to give people an idea, I typically don't do this. I'm not going to try to read verbatim. Just give you an idea. This is very short and sweet. Nasty demeanor, very fast processor, bends at the hips and knees to create leverage. Grip strength shows up, stays latched on, and you see defenders jerk down violently when they try to bull him, and he's able to work a snatch. Violent finisher, very quick out of his stance, and that's with him having to snap the ball. Wrestling background shows up on tape. He's got a clip. I haven't tweeted this out, but it's like a single leg takedown on a guy in the game. And it's not a penalty. It is a completely legal play, but I'm like, that is a move directly from the wrestling man onto the football field. But I really enjoyed watching. I mean, he's got that squatty body type. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, if he's going to have maybe some of the other physical dimensions you want to stick at guard, but man, he's a fun guy to watch.
Yeah, he's going to be very, very highly drafted. I think he may go in the first round. He's a guy who I absolutely love. He's my number two interior offensive lineman.
Okay, you're really high.
Finishes and refinishes block is one of the big things. And the wrestling background is it's in there. It's and it's been talked about a lot. But he puts a guy on the ground and then the guy even tries to raise his head. He hammers him again. It's just it's just the most brutal butt kicking of a player. He's happy. I feel like you know the one that they thought should have been a penalty, a lot of people thought should have been a penalty against the Chiefs in the AFC Championship game, where one of the guards, that might have been Trey Smith, the right guard, fell back on top of a Ravens defender. Mm. And, you know, they're calling some pretty cheap stuff in that game. And then that happens. And, you know, you really get upset about that anyway. But anyway,
this is not just any old wrestling background either. This is 4-time heavyweight state champ, only lost two matches.
How do you do that in ninth grade? How the hell do the prototype wrestler to me are these undersized guy. They may even have growth or hormonal issues who end up weighing about 100 pounds and their growth is stunted somehow, but they're a senior and they weigh 100 pounds and they get the privilege of facing a lot of seventh and eighth and ninth graders. Cause they're the only guy who can make weight at that level for some schools. I'm amazed at that.
One of those genetic lottery type of guys, I guess.
I mean, I thought lots of things were on there. There's a great highlight I saw of him where he actually maintained his engagement and held a guy down from getting a PD at the line of scrimmage. That is it's a thing I charge linemen for, is a PD by their opponent on a pass blocking play. So they get a -2, same as a pressure. So you got to be able to control your guy, got to punch him in the gut, got to do whatever you need to do to not let him get his hands up. In his case, kind of grabbed him by the jersey and pulled him down and didn't allow the ball to get deflected. I didn't see if a penalty got called, by the way, but it was one of those things you really love to see.
He gets his hands inside and he gets them on that breastplate and you can't move. They can't go up. They can't go down. They can't go left or right. They can't go anywhere. And I'm like, man, this guy, I had heard the stuff, and I try not to listen to a ton of stuff before I watch guys, because again, I don't want to bias myself, but I'd heard a little bit about him and I was like, okay, well, we'll see. And I watched him and I was like, wow, this is really cool.
All right. Well, anyway, my number two guy, and we're talking about some of the cream of the crop here. The only, I mean, he's to me, he's probably a pure center. But more than that, I almost think where it's, there's never a question about whether you guy want a guy to play tackle or guard. You always want him to play tackle over guard. But it's center or guard, there can be a question. Some teams, mm-hmm. they need a center, and they want a guy to lead their line, and they want a guy who can recognize the mic and, you know, do all the other things that the center does, and make sure they keep the cadence and remember all the information they have to just properly. But Zach Frazier seems to be the guy you build your offensive line around, and that would be a duplicative thing with the Ravens, even though Kevin Zeitler provided a lot of incremental value to what Linderbaum does. I just don't see Frazier maximizing his value at guard and being a guy, even though he probably is physical enough to do it. I think, you know, the Ravens have got two enormous guys right now and strength towers that I think are going to get the first chance there. And as good a player as Frazier is, I don't see the Ravens spending the extra draft capital to get him with all their other needs. So if he were available late in round two, somehow the Ravens might be in a position where they couldn't say no. But I don't see any way that he lasts that long with all the team's needs and the real dearth of IOL talent this year.
The only thing that I think could maybe depress where he goes a little bit is coming off of that broken leg. That might be the only thing. Now, from by all accounts, he's one of these guys training with Duke Mannyweather. People probably know Big Duke 50 on Twitter. Big offensive line training program that he's really built down there in Texas. And he's been running already. Like, he didn't work out at the combine yet because I don't think he had been medically clear, but in training to do all of that type of work. But with Duke, there was a guy who was writing a piece for The Athletic, and he went to go visit and talk to him about some of his guys who were going to be in this draft. And he's going through different guys, Armarius Mims and these other guys. And he's asking him about Frazier. How's he coming along? How's he recovering from the leg? And he's like, hey, come over here. And they walk in a room and he's sprinting on a treadmill. And he's like, all right, I guess this guy's doing okay. So he might be fine. It might not depress it at all. When it first happened, I was like, okay, how long, you know, is the recovery going to be? Is he going to be able to do any of the offseason stuff? Before not NFL offseason, but combine, pro day, any of that kind of stuff. And it was like, looking like, nah, he's probably not gonna be able to, but I don't know. He might get a pro day in. I don't know. Or at least he'll do some private workouts, maybe.
Probably. The thing about him is his growth along the strength curve, even going back to high school and mentioning this, a four-time heavyweight wrestling champion, his growth along the strength curve has outpaced everything all the way along the line. So it's not like he's going to lose developmentally in terms of doing the last little bit he needs to get his body grown man strength ready. I think he's probably already there. Yeah. So if you're talking about potentially losing some reps, I don't think he'll lose that if he's already running now. I think he'll be able to get in there and get his opportunity in camp. So maybe, but you know, it's not a knee injury. It's not an Achilles. It's not something Liz Frank where he's, you know, has a really long return time to it. You know, obviously it's great to hear the news that you know, they're, you know, his guru is showing him off basically in terms of yeah. recovery project, but that's great. So anyway, that was your number seven, right?
That was
Zach Frazier.
Yeah.
Okay. So my number seven is Dominic Pooney. And let me get down to my notes on him here, make sure that I'm doing it right. He's a guy who's played tackle in his career, and he's one of the guys that I'm moving to guard for purposes of this. 6'5", 320, 22 years old, and that's one of the big features of him. The 22-year-olds, that's young for an offensive line to be coming out. He played at Kansas. Outstanding pass-blocking season at left tackle with only 8 pressures allowed. Now, that's terrific. I'm very happy for him. But I still think he probably moves inside to guard because he's a little shorter armed than your typical tackle. Not as effective as a run blocker, but in truth, I think he was playing out of position in 23. He played some guard before that. You may have even seen him at guard as part of your process to go through this. Pretty good mirror, but he's not nearly physical enough as a pass blocker, in my opinion. Doesn't really use his arms enough, doesn't punch. In fact, I have it here. Use your damn hands. It's my note on the guy. He's an apple. He's not a pear. So he ends up being a little bit of a tweener here, being a guy who doesn't really have the right shape to play guard, doesn't have the right length to play tackle, was effective at tackle. So I could see why people might want to try and leave him out there. Probably the team that really values a swing player will get him. I really, really hope that is not the Ravens, because I don't want them to try and address their very deep tackle need with a swing player. That said, he's just too damn good for me to leave him off the list. So I put him in at number seven. I think And there's some boards I see have him going as high as round three. I think the Ravens get value in round four if he lasts to that point. And yeah, he might not be the one to last, but someone will. And if they got Pooney in round four, at least I wouldn't feel bad about it.
Yeah, I like Pooney a lot. He's number five on my list. So I actually had him a couple slots higher. I had him at 24 years old. I got him February 24th, 2000, because he actually, he's one of those guys who transferred from lower level. He had four seasons at University of Central Missouri before he came to Kansas for 2 years.
You know, honestly, I would drop him had I known that. You sent me a spreadsheet of some stuff on it, but I had looked up his birthday independently and thought it was 2022 or maybe 2021, but I have him as listed as 22 years old here. Interesting.
Yeah, because I've got him. He started out at University of Central Missouri, D2 school. He was there for four seasons. Let's say, he started all 13 games at left tackle in 19, played seven games in 18 as a true freshman. They canceled 2020 season because of COVID. Then I think he got hurt in 21. Yeah, after week one against Pitt State, he tore his MCL. And then he transferred to Kansas State 22 and then played 23. So, yeah, I've got him at 24. Another cool story, going from D2 to Power 5. Volleyball player in high school, 3 and 4 years. It's pretty cool. You don't see a lot of volleyball player. I mean, you look at his body type and say, okay, yeah, I can see why this guy might, you know, volleyball coach might want this guy. But I think it was kind of cool in that he had some FCS offers out of high school, but he had two brothers who played at University of Central Missouri. So he actually got to play one of his brothers on the O-line. So I think his brother was the right tackle. So he got to play left tackle or right tackle. I got to play with both his brothers for one season while he was there. And he probably would have stayed there. But he said that last year when he got hurt, his offensive his head coach retired and his offensive line his head coach got a job at Tulane. His offensive line coach retired. And that's why he transferred. He's otherwise, I would have stayed there. But another pretty impressive jump to go from D2 to Power 5. And you kind of covered everything. But yeah, I was a big fan of him.
So number five on your list.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I tell you what, we're going to call it there for the first show since we have a lot of different players. We actually have fewer total players to talk about in this next show since we have mostly overlap in our remaining list would be my guess. But Michael, incredible pleasure. I mean, I get excited talking offensive line play with you. And one of the things that you'll really appreciate about Michael's work, if you look it up, whether it's the Fire Zone show or what's the other one?
Deep Cover,
there you go. Is there's a completeness the way he looks at things, and there's almost an anal retentiveness to his draft process that you can pick up on here correctly. But he did for 5 years. He charted every run play that the Ravens did, and he and Josh Mastaiko, who did a lot of the data work behind the scenes on this, did a great job of putting together a tool that is of tremendous value. And when I talk about what really good analytics work is, it starts with defining the universe in a complete manner. And those two did a great job of you having a complete universe of data. This time of year, there are a lot of predators out there who will show you one clip that's their narrative on a player. And if it's that, those are not the guys you want to be getting your draft information from. They are not. You need people who do complete study work. And Michael, you really trust to do that. Listen, ask them what their process is. Ask them how they look at a draft prospect and try to figure out if they're good. But Michael is that guy. Michael, tell folks without me droning on for a long time about here where they can talk football with you online.
So you mentioned the two podcasts, Deep Cover, who I do with Chris Aguilera and Kerry Stevenson. Been pretty infrequent this past season, but, you know, a lot of that was with me and kind of prioritizing some different things. But we'll see if we can't pick it up again going into this season. And then the Fire Zone show with Denard, Melvin Denard, much more of a stern taskmaster, no time off, no days off. So we hit that pretty regularly this year. But you can find me on either one of those two. And then, you know, still out there on X/Twitter. I don't post as much stuff as I used to publicly, but I still try to do the work behind the scenes. So that's one thing that Ken just talked about it. Like, you may not agree with me on certain things, and that's fine. That's all part of the process. I think that's a good thing. But if you ask me, how did I get there? I feel like I can always show you how I got there. And then, you know, you can kind of judge for yourself whether you agree or disagree, but it's not a black box. I will tell you and show you anything that I have.
And in the years we've done this podcast, there's been no more engaging guest that I've really enjoyed talking football with than you, Michael. And I hope we can continue to have you on for pods, even after maybe you feel less comfortable about your opinions because you're doing less. So if that day ever comes, I still going to want you on the show because you're a great thought experiment person that I love talking football with. Other folks out there, if you're interested in doing a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. It's a short window here to get a draft show done of some sort, either before or after. If it's a review of draft process, could that be done? You know, maybe some trend you saw in this year's draft that you want to talk about afterwards. That's fine. If you want to do a recollections pod talking about one favorite player of yours from Ravens history, love to do that with you. Just send me their name in a direct message. They're always open, and I'll get back to you very quickly. We'll schedule when we can do that. Michael, thanks for coming on. We'll have you back in just a few minutes for part two.
It was a blast. Look forward to it, Ken.
And talk to you next time on Film Study.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.